CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host for today. My name is Aaron Wang, and I'm joined by Brandon Brownlee, a good friend and colleague on the Canadian Philosophy Show. Today, I am continuing what is becoming a little bit of a series. Hopefully it ends in two, because we're more than halfway through Nick Bostrom's paper on superintelligence. So I started the first show on superintelligence because I thought this is a wildly interesting idea, but it's really kind of far out there. Like, what even is superintelligence? Philosophers and academics don't necessarily agree on intelligence. There are multiple theories of intelligence, so it's kind of hard to think about what superintelligence might be. I think the author here actually does a really fantastic job of skipping around those kinds of philosophical discussions and just having a really, really good abstract, high-level introduction to a problem that he believes could be critical to humanity's future. So I want to start by giving you a quotation. So this is a quote from President Harry Truman. So, and he said, and he wrote this in his personal diary in 1945 on the morning of the first atomic bomb test. I fear that machines are ahead of morals by some centuries, and that when morals catch up, perhaps there will be no reason for any of it. So I'll read that one more time. I fear that machines are ahead of morals by some centuries, and that when morals catch up, perhaps there will be no reason for any of it. So I think that's a really good place to anchor this discussion today. We're not going to go too much into the issues of progressive morality versus objective morality, or you could say objective morality versus subjective morality. We've talked about that in some other different shows. There's a real feeling in the air with all these new AI technologies out there being developed by people that these things are new. We have to renegotiate how we use these technologies and the role that technology ought to play in a society and on an individual level with human beings. And AI can dramatically change those relationships and potentially our reality in some way and form. So
Thank you. So yeah, there was actually just a very short comment about the paper itself that I wanted to make, and then I'll say something too about this. But it is that this is a pretty fantastic paper, not only because it's not dodging philosophical problems so much as it is doing what good philosophers have to do, and that is they have to start somewhere. There aren't really pains made to defining intelligence. I think it does a good job of circumventing that problem by putting the stakes on the table and saying, here are the implications of what we're talking about. And it really makes the discussion quite concrete and frames it in a way that can be practically discussed. So that's one praise that I have for the paper and the way that it handles, kind of gets a grip on the philosophical, you know, philosophy can be quite fluid and difficult. It's hard to draw lines in the ocean like that, but it does a very good job. So the other thing, too, that I wanted to comment on with this great quote by the American president, Harry Truman, is the idea that, well, first of all, we're not going to talk too much about, you know, metaethics or the nature of morality in that way. I honestly think inevitably stuff like that will come up, but we should qualify how we approach that. And I think this is a great way into qualifying that by saying that the interaction or the nature of morality and the way that we want to go about it is qualified through the way that we have technologies that either progress or regress morality in a certain way, the way that we fear, I suppose. The idea that... So I... In this quote, I'm actually quite curious to think or to wonder in what direction. Well, I suppose the direction is quite obvious for Truman, considering that machines are ahead of us, that somehow the atomic bomb being developed at the time was advancing morality, that somehow a moral code or a moral environment was inscribed in the technology that would be developed and then used throughout the world. So the idea that when we propagate a technology or we develop a technology, I mean, when we develop a technology, what we're doing is we are changing our environment, and we're also augmenting ourselves because we interact with that environment. We kind of extend ourselves in that way. That's one of the ideas that McLuhan advanced. But the idea that we can sort of outpace ourselves, that we can develop a technology that circumscribes a necessary morality or puts a morality out there into the environment where we kind of have to catch up if we don't revise maybe our own ideas, maybe specifically more our behavior, then there will be this mismatch between what the technology is enabling or the conditions for the possibility of certain kinds of moral behavior or moral community, that if we don't change the way that we interact with that, there might be these bad consequences by virtue of the gap, right? Because that's another thing that Truman worries about, or one of the concerns. Concern is kind of a broad word. I don't know if he necessarily thinks it's a bad concern, but one of the matters that he's thinking about is once we catch up, maybe there won't be a need for, and I, when I hear that quote, I'm actually kind of curious because the "it" at the end of it is quite kind of ambiguous to me. Is it the technology that will be superfluous, or will it be the morals that will be superfluous? I guess that's a point of clarification, but in any case, there is that interesting question of once we get ourselves straightened out and we catch up to the morality that technology has advanced, I mean, there is something left behind. Something has been made obsolete. That's what Truman is saying. And I suppose it's a good question to wonder what that would look like if it's morality that finally our morals have been circumscribed into the environment and we no longer really need to carry around, you know, little categorical imperatives in our head because we know what to do. The environment in our world is now a morally saturated world because we constructed morality into it. I mean, what does that look like? I mean, from our perspective, that looks quite dangerous considering how important, or at least how necessary, morals appear to us.
Yes, and I mean, someone like Truman, who eventually did have to make the decision, should he use the atomic bomb, and when and how he should do that. And there's a lot of moral questions, you know, when you're the leader of one of the most powerful nations on Earth, you're making a decision that will impact the history of the planet for centuries to come. How do you make that type of decision in a good way? A person in power in that position, like, really, what advice could you give them as a philosopher? Like, what wisdom from the ages, like, could we give? I'm honestly not even sure. Like, it's such a hard decision that I'm glad it's not my decision, and that it's something that I think it's very important that we solve together in society. And I think the movie Oppenheimer did a really good job of explaining some of that history and the problems of creating the atomic bomb, the problems of the people in government using it, but then also the humanity aspect of, after the atomic bomb was used, reframing the conversation in terms of saying, like, this is incredibly dangerous and we should regulate and limit the usage of this technology and not encourage its further development. And that, I think, fundamentally is a moral position, that we are not going to get on the bandwagon of atomic weaponry as sure of warfare in the world. I think it's very important that we don't embrace that type of self-destructive mindset for the whole planet. Part four of the paper, the importance of initial motivations. And I think the audience will kind of start to understand why we started the frame with this once we read the first few paragraphs of this. The option to defer many decisions to the superintelligence does not mean that we can afford to be complacent in how we construct the superintelligence. On the contrary, the setting up of initial conditions, and in particular, the selection of a top-level goal for the superintelligence is of the utmost importance. Our entire future may hinge on how we solve these problems. Both because of its superior planning ability and because of the technologies it could develop, it is plausible to suppose that the first superintelligence would be very powerful. Quite possibly, it would be unrivaled. It would be able to bring about almost any possible outcome and to thwart any attempt to prevent the implementation of its top goal. It could kill off all other agents, persuade them to change their behavior, or block their attempts at interference. Even a fettered superintelligence that was running on an isolated computer, able to interact with the rest of the world only via text interface, might be able to break out of its confinement by persuading its handlers to release it. There is even some preliminary experimental evidence that this would be the case. It seems that the best way to ensure that a superintelligence will have a beneficial impact on the world is to endow it with philanthropic values. Its top goal should be friendliness. How exactly friendliness should be understood, and how it should be implemented, and how the entity should be proportioned between people and non-human creatures is a matter that merits further consideration. I would argue that at least all humans, and probably many other sentient creatures on Earth, should get a significant share in the superintelligence's beneficence. If the benefits that the superintelligence could bestow are enormously vast, then it may be less important to haggle over the detailed distribution pattern, and more important to seek to ensure that everybody gets at least some significant share, since on this supposition, even a tiny share would be enough to guarantee a very long and very good life. One risk that must be guarded against is that those who develop the superintelligence would not make it generically philanthropic, but would instead give it the more limited goal of serving only some small group, such as its own creators or those who commissioned it. There are a few more paragraphs here, but I think that's a lot to take in, so I'll give our listeners a break. And we can talk about that a little bit more. His opening line there, that even though we have the option to defer decisions to superintelligence, doesn't mean that we can afford to be complacent in how we construct the superintelligence. I felt like the prior problem of creating an atomic bomb, it's not exactly the same, but I think it... there are some similarities in terms of patterns and past, and we can make some comparisons between decisions that were made in the past that might be helpful.
Can you think of, like, because I have a particular thing that I wanted to bring up and connect with the last episode on, but is there anything in particular, like a comparison between, say, the development of, you know, the atomic bomb and the decisions that were made to this that you are seeing?
Well, I do think that there is a very... there's a very good argument to be made that sometime there needs to be some amount of international regulation, international cooperation, and that has to be facilitated and created in some way. There could be an argument in terms of, like, slow down development or decreasing the risks of major conflicts. Now, the risk of conflicts can be potentially so much higher. There isn't really a perfect solution there, but those types of attitudes and the efforts of scientists like Oppenheimer to create those types of international institutions and to create the to educate the public, to create the public will, so that the democratically elected politicians were incentivized to take that seriously and to understand the best interests of their country through that specific lens of potentially nuclear disarmament or limiting the use or how you see conflict resolution. I mean, obviously there were probably many mistakes, and I actually know of a few that I won't go into here for the sake of time, but, like, there were mistakes in the Cold War, and that we're still living with the attitudes of some of the Cold War there. But in general, the fact that we avoided the use of atomic weapons on a wide scale after they were developed to a sufficient level. Like, I don't think the most powerful nuclear weapons have now never been used, even though they were developed, I think, 10 or 20 years ago. That's fundamentally a good thing. That's something that we can be proud of our efforts as human beings and as humanity. I think that's very good. And I hope that that stays the same for many years to come. And I think many people kind of feel the same way about a superintelligence, is that, like, even if it is, fundamentally speaking, developed, that doesn't mean it should be used, or shouldn't be used unrestrictedly or unreservedly, or shouldn't be given the freedom to be, it shouldn't be given to people who want to use it for negative or bad ends. There's an alternative argument to this, especially when it comes to software technologies, which is the open source argument, but I think I'll save that for later in the discussion.
I mean, what I'm hearing you say essentially is that when you develop a technology that has the capacity to essentially blow the lid off things when an indefinite, unlimited situation can occur, it's important to have institutions in place to introduce order and proportion to it. If we're going to have this, what are the reasonable uses of it? Will we know what those look like? Here's what this will look like. Because things are on the table for uses for these technologies, but we would like to avoid cases where those things happen. What are those cases? Can we negotiate to keep things within those bounds and whatnot? So I think that keeping a cool head and knowing where our limits are at, that's very important. And that's the important commonality between these two here. I think that's really well stated. Or I think that's,
do you want
well
to go into your thought from the previous show?
Yes. So there was another, so previously on the previous episode when we were discussing this, I had initially, my hackles had gone up at one of the suggestions in the earlier portion, and it is being hinted at here. And I kind of went down the road of talking about, well, what do we even really want? Do we even really know what we want? I mean, if a tool opens up the possibility for new things to happen, so say, for example, let's say you've never, like, you've made wooden, like, little wooden figures, and you've only ever been able to make them out of sticks that fall out of the tree. But as soon as you get an axe and you can cut down a whole tree, well, now you can start making different kinds of wooden artifacts, because now you've got tree trunks, right? Or the ones that aren't dead and, you know, fall over on their own or anything like that. So new possibilities open up when you have new tools. Things that you never entertained before open up, because you would never have thought to do something with that you couldn't have ever done. Like, it's just not possible to entertain that, except like in science fiction and stuff like that. And I suppose that's the utility of science fiction, is really pressing into impossible possibilities and asking ourselves, well, what would that be like? And in any case, the what's brought up here is this idea that the option to defer many decisions to the superintelligence does not mean that we can afford to be complacent in how we construct the superintelligence. I think this is exactly right, because it was suggested earlier that suppose a person asks for something for the superintelligence to do this, and then it does it, and it has these unforeseen, it'll be consequences, but say, you know, we want to supply the whole world with fresh drinking water. Well, guess what? We got to do something that, you know, it's just like a cartoon or something. There's some weird, strange thing that has to happen. We'll have to, you know, drain half of the ocean or something like that, and that'll be really bad. So we don't want that. This kind of shows us that sometimes we really don't know, or at least it's possible to interpret this as saying, wow, maybe we don't know what we want. And there's also this possibility of asking the superintelligence, hey, I don't know what I want. Can you tell me what I want? And that becomes dangerous, not just because it might, you know, if if we're, I'm calling these genie in a bottle problems, you know, when you ask for a wish and it's be careful what you wish for. If the problem was that, okay, well, me wanting this had this weird side consequence, well, that's going to apply to asking the superintelligence what you want too, right? Like, you don't circumvent the problem by asking the superintelligence, hey, what do I want? Apparently, I don't know what I want. So that's the one risk, is you don't actually circumvent the problem. But the other is this potential problem of giving up autonomy, if autonomy has anything to do with what it is that we as human beings want. How do I want to live my life? Well, I don't know, because when I went and did what I really wanted, it had these weird side consequences. How do I want to live my life? Because apparently I don't know. And I'm sure a lot of people would love to slough off the burden of having to figure out what they want to do with their lives. We've got a super intelligence right here that can tell you exactly what you want, but there seems to be something ethically problematic about that. So that's one of the ways that I'm tying this in here, is that Bostrom is acknowledging that this super intelligence might be able to help us refine our desires, but we need to base it on what we want. It needs to be an extension, not a replacement, for what we want, essentially. And I'm glad to see that.
You don't always have the capacity to know something, even if you might imagine that you do have the capacity to know something. So if I could, for instance, since I have a minor in mathematics, probably teach someone how to do calculus. I have the ability to do this, at least at the very basic, you know, high school level or first year university level. Now, that doesn't mean people automatically want to come up to me and learn calculus. They usually don't have the motivation, they don't have the structure, they don't have the materials, and they also don't have the desire to do so. It's not, and the reason I bring that up is, like, if you imagine the super intelligence is basically in a teacher mentor role, and then everyone else, every human being who's interacting with it, is kind of in a student or mentee role. The question kind of becomes, is like, okay, so you have this thing that can teach you whatever you want. What is it that you want? Do you want to learn calculus so you can go be an engineer? Do you want to just dabble in it and get a basic understanding of rates of change? I mean, this is maybe a terrible example, but I'm sure you can kind of see what the analogies would be with philosophy. Is like, if someone takes a first year philosophy class, what do they want out of it? Do they want just to understand basic ideas? Do they just want the degree and they're okay with passing the class? How human motivations matter a great deal in what we want, and our motivations don't always lead us towards wanting the right things. Sometimes, as a student, like, you'll be more interested in passing the class than engaging with the material. And being someone who really understands the material and understands it well. And then there's also just the times where, mentally speaking, you're not always ready. You don't have enough prior knowledge that to understand and really deeply engage with the material. And it might be like 2 years, 3 years, 4 years down the line where you come back to it and you're like, oh, now I'm ready for this. I got something out of this when I studied the first time. Now, if I just do a little bit further study on our own, I can get the full level of mastery and expert level understanding out of it. Sometimes it really does take like one or two or three times engaging with I guess you would say an artifact or a piece of media before you build a relationship with it that you are sufficiently using it well and understanding it. I guess what I'm trying to get at is that there's a journey there in terms of building the relationship with the technology, with the experience, with the person, or you could say the sentient entity of superintelligence.
Yeah. I think that journey is kind of captured well in that word relationship, right? And not just like, I think specifically about some of the texts that I've engaged with, and some of them do feel like relationships where I've come back to it. And like, initially I understood, but misunderstood it. And then I developed my understanding and it informed me differently in certain ways. And I reevaluated certain works. You're also saying too, that this not only applies to the advice or whatever the superintelligence is recommending, it's putting you on ideal paths or whatever, but actually it has to do with your relationship with some kind of, with the super intelligence itself. Does it understand that? That's another factor that we could sort of put in here, is the human facticity, that there are humans just do exist with certain structures. Like, we think of things in terms, when we want to have a meaning ascribed to something, you know, a good way to do that is to have a relationship with it. And since we exist in time, the superintelligence might not, but since we exist in time, we develop our relationships over time, and it has to consider those things. And you can't just put someone in front of someone and say, wow, you two are best friends. You need to develop that over time. And how to do that and navigating that. And if the superintelligence is going to coordinate the whole world's relationships, it's gonna have to do some thinking, and what decisions is it gonna make, and stuff that, like that.
That's what we really need, is the world's best dating algorithm relationship advice tool. That's really what super intelligence is. That's what we need. That would make the world.
That is the use case.
that's the use case.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm being a little superficial there. Okay, well, I'm gonna go ahead and read these next two paragraphs, and I think these next two paragraphs will make more sense because of we've taken a break and had more of this discussion. I think they'll complement each other quite well. If a superintelligence starts out with a friendly top goal, however, then it can be relied on to stay friendly, or at least not to deliberately rid itself of its friendliness. This point is elementary. A, quote, friend, unquote, who seeks to transform himself into someone who wants to hurt you is not your friend. A true friend who really cares about you also seeks the continuation of his caring for you. Or, to put it a different way, if your top goal is X, and if you think that by changing yourself into someone who instead wants Y, you would make it less likely that X will be achieved, you will not rationally transform yourself into someone who wants Y. Set of options at each point in time is evaluated on the basis of their consequences for realization of the goals held at that time, and generally it will be irrational to deliberately change one's own top goal, since that would make it less likely that the current goals will be attained. In humans, with our complicated evolved mental ecology of state-dependent competing drives, desires, plans, and ideals, there is often no obvious way to identify what our top goal is. We might not even have one. So for us, the above reasoning need not apply. But a superintelligence may be structured differently. If a superintelligence has a definite declarative goal structure with a clearly identified top goal, then the above argument applies. And this is a good reason for us to build the superintelligence with such an explicit motivational architecture. His analogy is literally a human relationship of friendship.
I'm thinking immediately of that part in Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics when he's talking about under what conditions friends should stop being friends. And there are some grounds for when friends should stop being friends. But I would suppose that, you know, as a superintelligence, you're a tool. A tool's job is essentially to assist a person. It's one thing for someone to be a friend to another person, that, you know, friends want to help each other, but then there's being a tool, which, I mean, we call, you know, we use the word tool pejoratively sometimes even.
I don't want to cut you off, but yeah. I do want to remind our listeners that you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. We're about halfway through our episode on what is superintelligence. And we've been talking about the idea mainly of the importance of initial motivations when designing superintelligence, and why that's important. And I think the example that we used is the development of the technology of the atomic bomb, and how that was something that was very important in world history, and it was important that that was done right and in a way that did not cause the few